Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 132, recorded Sunday, August 27th, 2017. This is the podcast given the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Just one topic on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: what travel apps are on my phone? So coming to you, as always, it seems, from the Travel Commons studios outside of Chicago, Illinois, you know, it seems that I guess I've swapped the romance of hotel bathrooms for the sound quality of the studio here. Seems like just yesterday when I was recording the intro in the business class toilet of a South African Airways A340 on the way down to Joburg. Well, this week I'm coming to you today by popular demand from the business class toilet, or loo, of a South Africa Airlines Airbus A340 somewhere between New York and Johannesburg, South Africa. No, I'm not going to do the entire show from here. I think there's probably some other passengers that may want to use this room for what it was designed for, and I think the background noise is going to be a little bit much, but, you know, the Travel Commons Twitter followers demanded a return to this podcast's roots, recording in the bathroom of wherever I may be, and so here I am on a 17.5-hour flight, 6.5 hours to Dakar, Senegal, and then what, I don't, you know, 10, 11 hours across Africa to Joburg. You know, that's a real live lesson on how big Africa is. So, okay, I think I hear somebody rustling outside the door, and I've got a glass of South African Cabernet waiting for me back in seat 4G. So, you know what, I'll finish the rest of this in my hotel in Joburg later this evening.
Yeah, those were the days. My travel since the last episode hasn't been, doesn't seem quite as exciting. Trips to Richmond, Baltimore, New York City. Indeed, I think if I had tried recording in the toilet of one of those American or United Airlines A321s, I don't think I would have gotten much past, "Hello, this is Mark Peacock," before someone had started to bang on the door. You know, Richmond Airport continues to be a problem for me. Not the airport itself, just the carriers flying into it. I get up on a Tuesday morning, so sidestepping the Monday morning road warrior crush. iPhone notifications from American, TripIt, Google all say my flight is on time. So pulling up to the terminal, everything still looks okay. But then I walk through the doors and my phone just explodes. My 8:20 a.m. flight is now leaving at 4-something p.m. The next note is from American telling me that they've booked me now on the 11:45 a.m. flight. So instead of getting into Richmond at 11:20 a.m., I'm now due in at 2:40 p.m., over 3 hours late. Quick call to Amex Travel tells me that the early morning United flight has already left, so this American mid-morning flight ends up being my best option. And I talked about this in the last episode, since I've given up depending on airlines being able to meet their schedules, or I hadn't booked anything right after that 11:20 a.m. expected arrival time. So, you know, so it wasn't critical. I just parked myself in the Admiral's Club and got some work done. Nothing lost, but just a bit of sleep. But with this in mind, I was just gritting my teeth when I had to head back to O'Hare the next week for my flight to LaGuardia. Now, I haven't had to fly into New York much recently, and when I have, I've flown into Newark just to avoid the sort of nightmarish delays that have been reported from LaGuardia because of the construction. I mean, good thing they're finally reconstructing that third world terminal, but, you know, the bad thing is kind of the disruption between now and then. There'd been stories of people literally having to abandon their cabs on the Grand Central Parkway and walk up the exit ramp into LaGuardia. And then, you know, there's just flying between two of the U.S.'s most congested airports. I've always said that anything less than a 30-minute delay between LaGuardia and O'Hare is on time. So I booked my flights to avoid rush hour, leaving O'Hare at 4 p.m., arriving LaGuardia at 7:30, and then my return, leaving LaGuardia at 3:30 p.m. the next afternoon. So what happens? I land in LaGuardia on time. There's no taxi queue, and I'm into the Sheraton Times Square by a little after 8. no flight delays, no traffic. So I quietly offer up my first beer at the Three Monkeys Bar to the travel gods in true Thanksgiving. The next day, we finish up our meeting in Midtown an hour early. I walk out of the building to find all sorts of cabs. I mean, now, the first cab doesn't want to take me to LaGuardia. I don't have the time. But the second guy is more than happy to. So, you know, in I hop, and we make really good time across town to the tunnel, and then there's no traffic on the Grand Central. I tip the guy well, walk up to an American kiosk, see that I can stand by on the 1:30 p.m. flight, which will be boarding in about 5 minutes. I hit the TSA pre-check line, about five people in front of me. But hey, you know what? The TSA folks are kind of in good humor, and they're moving things right along. I hear the gate agent call my name as I walk up to the gate. The flight takes off on time, and it lands early. I mean, you know, American made up two of the 3 hours that they cost me the last week going into Richmond. So, and you know what? On a LaGuardia to O'Hare flight, they make that up. I tell you, I offered up a much bigger beer on Thanksgiving when I got home. So following up, you know, Mike Skinner took a couple of minutes to stop by the Travel Commons website and leave a comment about the last episode. Mike writes, longtime listener, really enjoyed the show. Thanks, Mike. I appreciate that. Mike, then he gets into the real meat. He said, your comments on the Dreamliner in the last episode were very interesting to me. I've flown one long haul on several occasions. And yes, the windows are fun to play with. But you didn't have any comment on what I think is the most important attribute. The 787 isn't just another metal tube. It's constructed from carbon fiber and can be pressurized to a higher level than most normal passenger jets. The environment inside is at a higher pressure, like being at 6,000 feet rather than 10,000 feet, with a higher level of humidity, air not so dry, and more refreshes. I found it a great plane to fly on a long red eye, or any five-plus hour flight. I'm looking forward to this fall when I'm flying one round trip, LAX to Sydney, in United's Business First cabin, a 14-hour flight. Mike, thanks very much for the comment. You're absolutely right about the 787's carbon fiber build, allowing it to be pressurized at a lower level. I'm not sure if that's because of an increase in strength from the carbon fiber or because it's less, you know, sort of, it's more impervious to the higher moisture content of the denser air. But I didn't notice any difference between my flight out on an A330 and my flight back on the 787. Of course, you know, it just may be that I wasn't paying enough attention to identify the negative, right? That I got less dry eye, less sort of cotton mouth, or that the flight wasn't a red eye. And so maybe I was able to keep myself hydrated more than I would have on a red eye. I don't know, maybe I would have noticed the difference on one of those 17-hour South Africa flights to Joburg those many years ago. Whatever the reason, though, anything that makes those long-haul flights more bearable is absolutely a great thing. So, Mike, safe travels on that upcoming flight out to Sydney. So that A330 flight actually didn't go direct to London last month. I was late booking my tickets, and so instead ended up flying Aer Lingus from Chicago to Gatwick by way of Dublin. And it's really the first time in, I'd say, at least 25 years that I've been through Dublin Airport. I mean, it was a nice enough airport, but crowded for what was an early Monday morning. I'm glad I didn't have to go through security again because I looked past the scanners and it looked like a little bit of a zoo parade over there. But, you know, adding now again to that, what has become this multi-episode thread about buying and using local phone SIM cards during international travel, I actually, on that connection through Dublin, I saw the first benefits of the EU's ban against mobile roaming charges. So on the flight over, I'd swap my US SIM for my UK SIM into my iPhone. And coming out of airplane mode in Dublin, I got what looks like sort of the typical welcome texts, but instead of giving me the roaming charges, they tell me that my UK plan is good in Ireland. Might seem kind of a minor thing, but at least for traveling within Europe, I think there are some real benefits. First is not having to burn through an hour or two at the beginning of your vacation, finding a phone store, and then going through the hassles of buying a pay-as-you-go SIM, which is not typically what these phone stores are really excited about selling. I mean, in Paris, I had to go to about three, I think I ended up going through about three different phone stores to finally find the SIM that I wanted. And in Hungary, T-Mobile wouldn't sell my wife a SIM without a Hungarian citizenship or registration or nationality card, something like that, which, of course, she didn't have because she's just a tourist. Now, luckily, my wife's cousin was with her, and her cousin was able to buy SIMs for all of us. But, you know, if now suddenly if I don't need to buy, say, a new French or Hungarian or Italian SIM to avoid roaming charges, well, that kind of hassle just sort of goes away. You know, even I wonder if there's a bit of an arbitrage opportunity also. Now that I have a UK, a French, and a Hungarian SIM, you know, do I figure out which one is the cheapest rate and then use that one for all my trips? I don't know. I probably got to read the new regulations a bit before I figure that one out. On my last couple of trips through Atlanta, it seems that the lines for pre-check, quite honestly, are configured. The entry is configured differently every time. I'm not quite sure why that is. I mean, every other airport, it's pretty static. You go to this set of lanes. But in Atlanta, for some reason, they want to change the entrance to the maze every time. So that's a little annoying. But they've also put in new parallel loading baggage x-ray machines into the Atlanta pre-check lines. Now, these are pretty common in Europe, but they're just now sort of dribbling into U.S. airports. Now, rather than queuing up and waiting for each person to put their stuff on the belt one after the other, sort of in a serial mode, there are four loading stations where a group of people each reach below, grab a bin, put it in front of them, and then put their stuff in it, and then push that bin onto the conveyor. And since there are four people loading at the same time, there's no, I don't know, call it performance anxiety to make sure that you've got your belt loading choreography flawless. And there's no eye rolling and foot tapping while you're waiting for those who don't. There are a couple of hassles, though. First, since it's new and most people are still in that sort of serial mode one after the other, they don't know that it's okay to break queue and step around to an empty loading station. Now, at many European airports, they have somebody telling you which loading station to go to, and it usually has sort of a numbered sticker on the floor. U, station 1, kind of U, station 6. TSA hasn't quite gotten with this program yet. But second, if you're in one of those, you know, if you're actually in kind of the front of the loading station, so number one, say like you're in the first one, it takes a little, kind of muscle to break the stream of bins that are coming down the conveyor and to shove your bin, you know, onto that conveyor, too polite. And you're just going to stand there watching a stream of bins go by. All in all, I think it's a definite improvement, but it needs a bit of, I don't know, say, process optimization. And hey, if you've got any thoughts, questions, a story, comment, travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send it along. The email address, comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com. You can use a smartphone to record and send in an audio comment. Send in a Twitter message to M. Peacock, or you can always post your comments on the Travel Commons Facebook page, or like Mike did, go old school and put them on the website at travelcommons.com. The only topic on today's Travel Commons podcast, what travel apps are on my phone? So I tell you, a few weeks ago, Jack Peacock from Northern Florida, you know, from the looks on the map, kind of where the panhandle connects to the peninsula, Jack pinged me on the Travel Commons Facebook page with a couple of questions. First was a genealogy question. You know, Peacock isn't a common last name in the U.S. And so when we Peacocks meet, where's the last name from? Where does your last name come from? Is kind of a typical icebreaker. Peacock is probably more more common. I found it more common in the South, especially when I was growing up in Memphis. And down South, Jack and, you know, some of the other Southern peacocks can often trace their roots way back to a Samuel peacock born 1671, probably in colonial Virginia, who had come over from the UK as one of the early settlers. My line, though, is from more recent immigrant stock. My dad grew up in Southport on the northwest coast of the UK, kind of between Liverpool and Blackpool, and came over to the US in 1956, so a little bit later. But that out of the way, Jack said that he and his wife are retired, have put their home and vehicles up for sale, and are getting ready to Airbnb around the globe. Geriatric gap year, as Jack puts it. I got to tell you, I am officially jealous. Which led to Jack's second question, what travel apps do I have on my iPhone? Now, this is kind of, it was actually a very timely question because Carlson Wagonlit Travel had just released a survey. I got pinged with it, where 80% of business travelers said their smartphone was the travel tool they can't live without, and 45% used airline and hotel apps as their main travel technology. So I went paging back through the Travel Commons archives, and I could see that I had touched on some categories of travel apps. So in the most recent iteration of my top 10 travel tips, I recommended some flight tracking apps, and way before that, I had done a bake-off of trip management apps. But I'd never really walked through what's in the travel folder on the front screen of my iPhone. Now, as longtime listeners know and have suffered through, I just can't go through a laundry list. I just can't quickly answer Jack's question. First, I need to build and drag you guys all the way through some sort of a framework that provides some structure to my laundry list, probably from way too many years of consulting. I think one way and an easy way to start is to split the apps between those with broad sort of general use, say like Google Maps, and those that are more specific to a situation, say the apps of the airlines you travel with most. Or maybe mass transit apps for a city you'll be visiting. So if we dig down now to the next layer of those specific categories, let's talk about those airline apps because, you know, kind of they popped up in that Carlson survey as some of the more commonly used ones. I have apps for the airlines that I use for probably 90% of my travel. So that would be American, United, Southwest, and Delta, in just about that order. And that's because living in Chicago, American and United have hubs at O'Hare. Southwest just about owns Midway. And then I have Delta for the odd flights between, I don't know, say Atlanta and New York. Now, that mix is certainly going to change based on where you live and what you fly. So in Boston, you may end up with JetBlue's app as being top of the list. If you're in sort of San Francisco or LA, maybe it's Virgin, maybe not, well, no longer Virgin, now Alaska. And in London, you're certainly going to have British Airways app, you know, kind of front and center. So I use these airline apps primarily for two reasons. One, electronic boarding passes, so I don't have to stop off at a kiosk. And then also flight status. Now, I've talked in the past episode about how I use the Where My Plane Is Now feature of United's app to track back the source of a Richmond flight delay, actually all the way back to Grand Rapids. It helped me get a sense of whether that delay was going to shrink or grow. And also, I would say that these apps are getting much quicker about pushing out flight status and gate change notifications. Indeed, these apps have gotten good enough that the independent, sort of more general flight tracking apps on my phone, FlightAware, FlightView, FlightStats, those are all now sort of on the bubble. Are they still earning their real estate? I'll probably delete two of them and keep one, either FlightAware or FlightView, because of how they show the projected flight path on a weather map. Now, you can find this in the United app, but you got to dig a bit for it. FlightAware and FlightView have it as their primary view. And again, I find that another good piece of information, looking at the weather between where I am and where I want to go. It's a good piece of information, again, when you're trying to think through flight delays. Now, you know, and as I was saying, one-off flights, I'm not going to load up their app. So, for example, I didn't load up the Aer Lingus app for my flight to London last month. If indeed Aer Lingus even has an app, I don't know. It's just not worth it for a single flight. I mean, it's the same reason that I've never loaded Alaska Air's app, even though I don't know, I seem to end up on them at least once a year. It's just, You know, it's just not worth the phone real estate, which is sort of the same reason I've deleted hotel apps from my phone. Even though that Carlson Wagonlit survey called out hotel apps as also being commonly used, I've never found any value in them, in the Marriott or Starwood apps. I don't know. You go through, and I've talked about this in a past episode, where Marriott always wants me to, you know, kind of pre-check in the night before on their mobile app. But when I get to the hotel and I get to the front desk, I still have to go through the same exercise of showing my driver's license and showing my credit card. So again, I'm really not sure what value those hotel apps provide. Same with Hertz and Avis apps, just have never seen the value. However, if I was Airbnb-ing, that's a tough noun to turn into a verb. If I was using Airbnb, there, that's easier, around the world like Jack is planning, I would probably load up their app. I think that would be, there would be a lot of value in that. Another specific app I have is MyEE. It's the app for the UK mobile carrier whose pay-as-you-go SIM I use whenever I go over to the UK. The last iteration of this app made it much easier than EE's website to do a SIM top-up, so it's now in my travel folder. A bit more general, kind of in the middle, kind of a bit more general app is the Priority Pass app, which gives me access to international airport lounges through my Amex Platinum card. It regularly updates its list of available lounges and has airport maps to help you find them. This came in really handy in Dublin, where the lounge was tucked away on a second floor with very minimal signage. They definitely did not want to be bothered. Another kind of general app is the companion app to my Blue Smart Roller bag. I've talked about this smart luggage bag. It connects to that bag via Bluetooth and then automatically locks it when it's out of range of my phone and displays the bag's location when I have to check it, usually on some sort of a regional jet or commuter flight that has minimal overhead storage space. The auto lock is probably the most useful thing, though I'm always kind of going hot and cold with that Blue Smart bag. So the app is sort of consistently on the bubble. I have both Uber and Lyft in my travel folder. I'll typically light both of those apps up when looking for a ride somewhere, comparing price, wait time. And as I mentioned during a broader discussion of ride sharing a few episodes back, all things being equal, I'll typically choose Lyft, but I use them both regularly. Now, as I mentioned earlier, 5 years ago, I reviewed the three main trip management apps, TripIt, TripCase, and WorldMate, and they sort of recreated the old company travel agents printed trip itinerary by integrating the separate airline, hotel, and rental car reservations. And they did it all for free in a mobile app. And then if you wanted real-time flight updates, then they charged you a fee. Now, in that review back in 2012, I liked WorldMate the best, with TripCase a solid second. Today, though, I use TripIt. Now, Carlson Wagonlit, the folks who just did that survey, they ended up buying WorldMate, I don't know, a year or so ago, and they closed it up at the beginning of the year. They just shut it down. It said it wasn't strategic to them. And Sabre, which runs TripCase, TripCase has just become this hot mess of advertising. So I had it for a while and deleted it. TripIt, though, and they're owned by Concor, the travel and expense tool platform, whatever you want to call it, who in turn is owned by SAP, the big ERP software company. TripIt has continued to invest and improve that app. I now, the last big release, the last big iteration, I really like it. The ability to share a piece of an itinerary, say a flight or a hotel, through iPhone's iMessage, I thought it was going to be a gimmick. It's been surprisingly handy for me. But the $50 a year TripIt Pro subscription for real-time flight tracking is definitely on the bubble because, as I mentioned before, the airline apps have vastly improved their flight delay notifications. So Google Translate has grown into a critical travel app for me. I've talked in a previous episode about how, sort of with the real-time translation through the camera, say pointing it at a menu and getting everything translated in one shot rather than having to type everything in, it's becoming pretty close to magic in my mind. Transit is another app that continues to solidify its hold on screen real estate. Transit covers mass transit, as you would guess from the name of the app, across North America and in major cities in Europe. Now, Google Maps will suggest mass transit routings, but Transit goes much deeper with things like real-time bus and subway data, and then they've also got bike share locations for cities like Chicago and New York. So if you want to, I mean, if you're a real mass transit nerd like I've mentioned I am, Transit is really the app to go with. But then there is, as I just mentioned, sort of the granddaddy, which is Google Maps. That is kind of the Uber travel app for me. I use it to plan trips. Say that trip we took over to Budapest, I assembled, say, 15 to 20 craft beer bars and put them all on a map before I left so that they were easy to find. I use it to find hotels, to check out neighborhoods with street view. How dodgy is it? Find out where I am, share recommendations. All this, as well as using it for directions to get from point A to point B. It is probably the most indispensable travel app on my phone. Indeed, it's the only travel app with its own screen real estate. It sits out on that front page as opposed to kind of sharing space in the travel folder because I want to be able to get to it in one click. So that's my list. That's my list of travel applications that that I've got on my iPhone. So what about you guys? I'd be interested to hear what travel apps you guys are using. So hit me up on Twitter, on Facebook, on email, or on the website, and let me know what you guys are using, what you guys find valuable, what is earning its place on your screen real estate, and we'll talk about it in the next episode. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 132. I hope you all enjoyed the show, and I hope you decide to stay subscribed. Check out the show notes for music links. And if you want to recommend Travel Commons to some of your friends, they can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes. Google Play is still a little odd. Have not been able to find us on Google Play. But anyhow, if you've got a story, thought, comment, gripe, or recommendation for a travel app that you want to share, send it along, text or audio file, to comment, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com. Or you can hit me up at mpeacock on Twitter. I think, you know, for 140 characters, you can probably give me your travel app suggestion. You can write them on the Travel Commons page on Facebook. Actually, Jack Peacock hit me up. He actually sent me a message on the Travel Commons page rather than leaving a comment, but you can do either. Or like Mike Skinner did, you can leave a comment on the website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everybody who takes the time to tweet, post comments. As you can see in this episode, I take listener requests, kind of like an old radio station. So thanks to everybody. So heading out to Scotland the end of next week, take my daughter back to her third year at University of St. Andrews. You know what I tell you, we've taken the opportunity with my daughter being over there to really sort of dig in. Last year, we went up north, up through Aberdeen, up that northeast coast. It was very, very pretty. Really hadn't spent a lot of time there. This time, we're going to head west. So grab the car in Edinburgh, head west through Glasgow, which I've never been to Glasgow before, so I'm looking forward to that. And then Oban, kind of look at the water, drink a little whiskey, go over to Skye, the Isle of Skye, do a little bit of hiking, a little bit of more whiskey at Talisker Distillery, and then circle back around to St. Andrews. So it's going to be I'll pick up a little content for the next edition of the podcast. But until we speak again, thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Take care. Bye now.